Blog Talk Radio.
I'd like to welcome all of you back to Ohio Exopolitics. I'm your host, Mark Snyder. Edward Albert Meyer is a one-armed farmer from Switzerland. He's 77 years old now. Most of the world knows him as Billy. Billy's a nickname he got because of his fondness of Western movies and Western clothes. He's had extraterrestrial contact since about the age of 5 years old, when he was a young boy growing up in Bulach, Switzerland, in a little area called Niederflux. He would get these telepathic messages to go out into the Horrigan Forest, and then out of the sky would come the silvery pear-shaped craft of an extraterrestrial man named Svoth, who would land in the field nearby and then bring young Edward Albert Meyer back to the ship and then take him up some 70,000 meters and tell him about his mission in life. And in this life, he was on a mission to be a teacher, a prophet, and he would teach an ancient universal teaching called the teaching of the spirit, the teaching of the life, the teaching of the truth, something that he had done before in previous lifetimes. You see, Edward Albert Meyer had lived at least six other very important lives on the earth as different personalities, but with particularly the same mission. He had been Enoch, Elijah, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Emmanuel, and Muhammad. And in the seventh lifetime, he will be the final prophet here on the earth, which will store in written form an ancient universal teaching called the teaching of the spirit. And this teaching is said to stem from ancient times, from extraterrestrial humans who came here in our ancient past some millions of years ago. For the first time, a group came here called the Lyrians, and they came back at about 389,000 years ago. Now, these extraterrestrials were giants by our standard. They were very advanced, both in their material consciousness and very advanced in their technology. And to the native Earth humans, they were truly overwhelming and truly astonishing. Some of these extraterrestrials violated certain rules and laws that they had, and they abused the native earth people, and sometimes they mated with them. So there was an agreement that was made, and the Meyer material is referred to as a codex, that some of these extraterrestrial humans would stay behind on the earth, and they would die here and therefore enter into the reincarnational patterns of earth, and that these humans would, in future lifetimes here on the earth, make amends for the damages that they were responsible for in their previous lives. And these extraterrestrial humans who in previous lifetimes lived on other worlds now are in various kinds of service to make amends for those rules that were violated. And the Meyer material talks about this codex, and some of the people that work around Billy now at the FIGU had lives in the ancient past and evidently could have been, or some of these individuals have been identified as being part of this codex. So as Billy grew up, and he met with Svoth for another 11 years, and Svoth told him to stay in the background and to focus on his writings. And one of the sources I've come across from Canada states that there are some 40 books that Edward Albert Meyer has written. I'm aware of 7 or 8 of them, and it doesn't surprise me at all that there could be 40 books written by Billy. I know his contact notes are written in booklets, and there are at least something around 600 contacts that Billy had with an extraterrestrial group called the Plejaren. Svoth was a Plejaren man, and the Plejaren originally allowed themselves to be called the Pleiadians, and most people in the UFO community know these extraterrestrials as the Pleiadians, but they don't know in 1995 that they revealed their true identity just before they left the Earth, and they revealed that they were from the Plejaren star system, some 80 light years beyond our Pleiades. And they live on a planet called Era that's very similar to our Earth, similar in composition, similar in ecosystem, similar in size. It has a much healthier atmosphere. We've lost much of our atmosphere on the Earth. The Earth in the ancient past used to have a much higher oxygen content. And because of that higher oxygen content, trees grew larger, animals grew larger. And that also played a role in our longer lifespans. But through various things, various kinds of pollution, our ozone has been depleted. We've let off a couple thousand nuclear explosions and tests and other such activities. And now our atmosphere is much too thin, and our population is much too high. The Plejaren keep their population at about 500 million, and their planet is roughly the same size as ours. They don't build roads. They don't have any kind of manufacturing on their planet. All manufacturing is done off-world. They live in a kind of balance with nature, both spiritually and physically. And part of the reason they keep their population lower is because spirits tend to come back sooner in a high population time. And one of the things that spirit forms do when they're in the spiritual realm between lifetimes is they process the material, the information that was gained by their material consciousness. Because spirit forms need a material consciousness in order to evolve. So the time between lives is when that information in the material consciousness is processed and those spiritual values are formed. See, the human spirit only stores the highest essence of evolutive values, and those would be evolutive values would be things like patience and love and honesty. And this is what goes on in between lives. So when the population is high on a planet, not only does it tend to destroy an ecosystem, but it also adversely affects what goes on in the spiritual realm and in the reincarnational cycles. You see, we all have something called a spirit form. And the spirit form resides in the center of our midbrain in an area called the superior colliculus. And the superior colliculus controls your eyesight and also the integration with other parts of your senses like hearing and things like that. And also in the superior colliculus is the pineal gland. So that central area is an important area. The energy of your spirit form goes out to the whole body and it enlivens every cell. The spirit form is placed into the body of a child 21 days after the sperm fertilizes the egg. Also, something comes in called the consciousness block. The consciousness block is your new personality and your new material consciousness. That kind of goes into your frontal lobe. Now, your previous life information goes into the subconscious. So you have to grow back up each lifetime. You have to re-educate your material consciousness. But in each one of these material lifetimes, you get a bit of a head start in that your subconscious will inspire you. Your previous personalities will inspire you. And you'll get something called impulses from what's called the storage banks. Now, in the universe, there are these storage banks, and they're called sometimes the German word here is Speicherbank. And in these storage banks is information. And we get something called impulses. Now, an impulse is like a signal. And depending on how it's used, the word impulse can mean a lot of things. For it could be an impulse could mean a sudden feeling or a thought. In medicine, an impulse is an electrical thing that travels down the nerve fiber to some target. For example, the brain may trigger an impulse for you to move your hand. In physics, an impulse is something that changes the momentum of something else. And Billy, as a young boy, growing up in Niederflux, before he even had any physical contacts of any kind, would get these impulses. And one evening, he was laying in bed, and he started getting these impulses. So he got up out of bed, and he crawled out of a lower window there and sat down on a bench and looked up at a beautiful starry sky. And he heard his own voice say, "Since ancient times, I've lived among the stars." And then in this particular writing, which is called How It All Began, the passage explains that he got these impulses from the storage banks and good memories filled him. So part of the evolutionary process of spirit forms are these signals, these impulses, which come out of these universal storage banks. And, for example, Billy has been able to pull down out of the storage banks 14 chapters of a book called The Goblet of Truth. Now, he's obviously very skilled at doing this. There is some skill associated with pulling information out of the storage banks. There's also something called spiritual telepathy, which Sloth taught Billy, which enabled Billy to communicate over vast distances with some of his extraterrestrial mentors. Billy met with Sloth for 11 years, and Sloth warned him about many things, particularly this time that we're coming into that's called the new millennium or the third millennium, a time of slowly approaching global collapse, a time of confusion and maliciousness, which is spreading all over the earth, a time when our leaders will become grandiose, will become megalomaniacal, they will overemphasize their own importance, and the people won't react well. The people kind of will become dumbed down. They'll become obtuse and lazy, indolent, indifferent. And this will be a breeding ground for conflicts. And we're starting to see the rise of conflicts all over the earth. We see one particular terrorist group called ISIS, which I think was probably originally created by Western governments. And there seems to be some focus on Western governments to have military campaigns under the guise of fighting terrorism. And I think in the case of ISIS, it's backfired on in them. And now they have a real, very, very difficult problem to face. Before we jump back into Contact 215, I wanted to read for you just a little bit from Billy's first contact with Askit. And this is right around Billy was 16 years old, and he climbed up on top of a hill and waited for this ship to approach. And it says, and this occurred, I think, in 1964, in August perhaps. But in any case, let me pick up here. It says, bitter cold prevailed at this early morning hour as I made my way to the favorite place of my thoughts, where I was often alone for so many hours, and where 16 days earlier, Sloth also announced to me the acquaintanceship with Askit, which was intended to occur on this night. Now, let me just throw something in here. Askit was an extraterrestrial human from the Tao universe. The Tao universe is a parallel universe to ours. It was created some 46 trillion years ago. Askit's people are known as the Timmers, and they moved into the Tao universe in the ancient past. So Billy is going to meet with Askit on this evening. Let me continue here. In spite of the sharp cold, I broke out in a sweat as I climbed the small hill on which the agreed place was situated. Arriving there, I did not have to wait long for some sort of thing, which was still supposed to come there, because arriving on the dome of the hill, I immediately saw a bright light plunge down from the sky and set down not far from me on the frozen, hard ground. The bright light went out, and I saw a matte silver discus-shaped object which stood majestically quiet on three landing spheres and appeared to wait for me. The disc's landing spheres were completely foreign to me because I had never seen such things with that kind of form before. After a short telepathic invitation, I approached the ship as if under a gentle compulsion, and at once was lifted in through an opening, just as if by ghostly hands, because there was neither a lift nor some sort of other entrance possibility. I had already earlier repeatedly experienced that with Sloth each time he brought me into a spaceship craft. However, the interior arrangement of the ship was fundamentally different in comparison to that of Thoth. There was only one single armchair present. Also, I was not able to see anyone. The ship was quite obviously unmanned and was remotely steered somehow. So without being asked, I sat in the single but very comfortable armchair. Even before I could sit properly, an enormous change occurred. A change which, in my life up to that point, had always only appeared to me as a dream and fantasy. The bright light which came from everywhere in the interior of the ship suddenly went out. And then suddenly, I seemed to be sitting outdoors. No longer could anything at all of the ship and the entire setup be perceived. And when in a reflex motion I drew my left hand in front of my eyes, I was no longer able to see it. The entire ship and myself had simply quite suddenly become invisible. Well, it goes on to explain how this ship took Billy eventually to Jordan, where he got out, and then Asket's ship landed. And Billy got into the ship with Asket. They went to Egypt, and they eventually traveled in these old underground corridors for quite some time, these old cubicle constructions far below the Giza Plateau, but they're about 72,000 years old. And that's where Billy saw the headquarters of the Giza intelligence. He saw their ancient spacecraft. He saw the guards. He saw religious artifacts, a Y-shaped cross. And he was really stunned by all of this. And when he left there with Asket, when they got to the surface, explained to him that there had been an extraterrestrial group on the Earth since about the fall of Atlantis that had used religion to deceive the people of the Earth. And they had been in touch with the Thule Society in Germany and with Hitler. And they had a kind of technology called telenotic impulses, which would affect people's perceptions, people's minds, and people's points of view. I wanted to pick back up, if we fast forward now, another 20-some years, I want to pick back up to a contact that Billy had in February 28, 1987. This is about 2 in the morning. The contact person is an extraterrestrial human named Quetzal. Quetzal was a Plejaran man. He was eventually going to become what they call a king of wisdom, or an Ishwish. And at this time, he was the commander of all the Plejaran ships in our solar system. And Billy and Quetzal start out talking about something called the Sabra and the Shatila massacre, which occurred in 1982. And Quetzal explained to Billy that this massacre took place as a result of planning made by Menachem Begin and Ariel Sharon. And they sent in these Christian militias, or they allowed the Christian militias to do these killings. But anyway, it was certainly planned by Ariel Sharon and Menachem Begin. The reason these Palestinians, at least the reason they gave, were massacred, and about 3,400 people were massacred in Lebanon in 1982. This Lebanon is north of Israel. And there were the president of Lebanon, Bakr Gemayel, was assassinated, and this massacre at Sabra and Shatila was kind of a payback for that killing or the alleged murdering of that president. Now, at line 11 in this contact, it says, through Ariel Sharon, very much disaster, evil, and pain, suffering, and death will spread in the new millennium, because he will be able to indulge uninhibitedly in his murderous and inhumane ambitions. In utter irresponsibility and in uncontrollable hatred against the Palestinians in particular, and also the Arabs, without any great and serious objection being raised by the Israelis or by the world. Now, on the first line, it says Ariel Sharon brought evil and pain, suffering, and death. Evil generally means the absence or the complete opposite of good. Evil can also be called profound immorality. However, evil can also be described as unbalanced behavior, involved expediency, selfishness, ignorance, neglect. Some synonyms of unbalanced are deranged, demented, disturbed, unhinged, and insane. And that's what the Meyer material is saying about Ariel Sharon and Menachem Begin. In line 13 of contact 215, it says, Ariel Sharon's actions will occur to the same extent as those of the Americans who, under the guise of fighting terrorism and the preservation of peace, will run on the same tracks with their global military interventions in the affairs of foreign countries. Now, the next thing that's talked about here is genetic engineering. And I have, and I know this is very controversial, and the Meyer material says that genetic engineering eventually will be a good thing. I'm not so sure it is yet, but I have a couple clips here that talk about first the, let's talk first about genetic modification in general.
Genetically modified organisms, or GMOs, have, as their name suggests, had their genetic character altered by humans. The notion of modification was developed by the founding father of modern genetics, the 19th century Austrian friar and scientist Gregor Mendel. Mendel studied plant variation, cultivated and tested some 29,000 pea plants, which led him to formulate the principles known as Mendel's laws of inheritance. In fact, humans have always crossbred both plants and animals to obtain hybrids with particular characteristics. In a broad sense, all domestic dogs descended from wolves are effectively GMOs. But in general, the term GMO applies specifically to organisms modified by modern biotechnology techniques. This usually involves implanting genes from one living organism into another, so animals or plants exhibit new properties, a process known as transgenesis. Researchers have, for example, taken a light-producing gene from a glowworm and implanted it into a cow embryo. While the future calf may not exactly glow in the dark, under the microscope, its cells will emit a gentle glow under stress. Much used in research, genetically modified organisms have many practical applications, particularly in the field of agriculture and food production. Industrial companies have perfected varieties of plants like maize, soya, and cotton, which are resistant to parasites, fungi, and diseases, or to certain harmful herbicides used in farming. Other GMOs are designed to improve the nutritional value of crops or to have beneficial health implications. For example, American researchers are working on a genetically modified banana, which acts as a vaccine against gastroenteritis. But GMOs are also a cause for concern. While there's no concrete proof they're harmful, environmentalists say more research needs to be carried out into their possible health risks. There's also the worry genes in certain plants have a tendency to disperse and contaminate other varieties, thus upsetting the balance of ecosystems. Large multinational food processing companies have also rendered some organisms unable to reproduce, meaning farmers have to buy new seeds for every subsequent crop.
Genetic engineering is also called genetic modification. It's the direct manipulation of an organism's genome using biotechnology. A genome is the complete set of DNA of any organism. Now, how do they directly manipulate an organism's genome. Sometimes they can use enzymes to literally cut DNA in half. But we'll talk about that later. What is a gene? A gene is the molecular unit of heredity of all living organisms. Genes hold the information to maintain and build our cells, pass on genetic offspring. Now the cell, which interestingly in the Latin means small room, is the basic unit of reproduction. Cells are the smallest unit of life that can replicate independently. And that's why cells are often called the building blocks of life. A cell has a nucleus, which is the center, in the center. And in the cell nucleus, we have the chromosomes. And in the chromosomes are DNA. I think I might have an interesting clip here. Hang on, it talks about chromosomes. I hope I do. Okay, let's listen to this. I like this one. What is a chromosome?
What is a chromosome? To solve problems that explain and predict traits and variations, we first have to understand cells. All living organisms are composed of cells. Cells work like little factories doing all the jobs inside your body that are needed to keep your body functioning. Your body is made up of many different kinds of cells, such as skin cells, muscle cells, and nerve cells. Some cells look like squashed bricks, some look like donuts, and many have irregular shapes. However, every cell, no matter what its job, has the same basic parts. All human cells have an outer border that's the boundary of the cell, called the cell membrane. A liquid material called cytoplasm is inside the cell membrane, and there's a large structure suspended in the cytoplasm called the nucleus. The nucleus is the part of a cell that contains the genetic information. The nucleus is surrounded by a nuclear membrane that, like the cell membrane, makes a boundary around the nucleus. Now let's explore chromosomes. Chromosomes are thread-like structures located inside the nucleus of animal and plant cells. Each chromosome is made of protein and a single molecule of deoxyribonucleic acid, or DNA. Passed from parents to offspring, DNA contains the specific instructions that make each type of living creature unique. The term chromosome comes from the Greek words for color, chroma, and body, soma. Scientists gave this name to chromosomes because they are cell structures, or bodies, that are strongly stained by some colorful dyes used in research. So what do chromosomes actually do? The unique structure of chromosomes keeps DNA tightly wrapped around spool-like proteins called histones. Without such packaging, DNA molecules would be too long to fit inside cells. For an organism to grow and function properly, cells must constantly divide to produce new cells to replace old, worn-out cells. During cell division, it's essential that DNA remains intact and evenly distributed among cells. Chromosomes are a key part of the process that ensures DNA is accurately copied and distributed in the vast majority of cell divisions.
Okay, let me pick back up in contact 215. It says, due to the irrationality and the irresponsibility of the genetic opponents, it will be that a lot of genetic progress for all humans, animals, and plants, as well as waters and air, and even for all of nature, will be prevented for many years, even though life could be prolonged by centuries through genetic engineering. And just through the genetic manipulations of the person, by what means his health could be stabilized. Namely, in a few decades, he would almost never get sick. So despite, you know, I think companies like Monsanto are probably producing things right now that aren't real good for us, but like genetically modified corn, for example. But eventually, genetic engineering can be very helpful for the human, according to the Meyer information. Now, I've talked about this before, but all the people on the Earth now have genetic manipulation in context 51. It's a long story, I won't go over it all, but a group of creator overlords. And they bred a genetically altered human being that had an enhanced aggression and would only live to be about 120 years old. And they were great fighters, and they did their fighting for this extraterrestrial group in the Sirius system. The Sirius system in a different space-time configuration than ours. In any case, the creator overlords decided that they no longer wanted these people around. They were too aggressive and they were a little bit dangerous. So they had decided to kill off these genetically manipulated people. Some of these genetically manipulated people escaped, and they escaped with people that are called benefactors in the Meyer material. These were people from the Sirius system who didn't have the same genetic manipulations. They were extraterrestrial humans that would live something like 1,000 years. I guess our normal lifespan would be about 1,000 years. Anyway, the genetically manipulated people were said to have settled on Mars first. And hundreds of thousands of years ago, Mars had an atmosphere, it had water, it had an ecosystem. And the genetically manipulated people, the civilization, space stations, they had pyramids, probably heard the Cydonia region on Mars, where there is the D&M pyramid in space. Also, there was another planet in our system, which was inhabited, it was called Melona. The genetic manipulated people built the planet, eventually destroyed that planet. They converted an ocean into a volcano, which caused... So anyway, I tell this story because genetic manipulation, genetic engineering is important for the people of the Earth because our lifespans will increase tenfold once we isolate the gene within us that has been manipulated. You see, these genetically manipulated people, some of them came to Earth and they spread this, I assume through sex, this genetic manipulation to all the people of the Earth. So now we all have this enhanced aggressiveness and this shortened lifespan. Anyway, we've been talking about cells. We've been, and I said that every cell has a nucleus, and within the nucleus, the chromosomes, and the chromosomes contain the DNA and the protein. And the DNA, deoxyribonucleic acid, is often depicted as being in what they call a double helix. Now, the double helix is these two columns of these two column structures that are connected by these horizontal structures, and the shape is a spiral called a double helix. And the two columns are parallel, but the word they use in is antiparallel because they said is the bottom of the other, etc., etc. DNA contains the genetic instructions of all living organisms. They can now insert DNA in a different kind of, for example, a Herb Boyer discovered a method to coax bacteria into producing foreign proteins. He would use an enzyme to cut DNA, and then they could put toad genes in there, and then the bacteria would start to be like a factory, which would start producing toad genes, which is kind of scary and very fascinating as well. I do have, I think, another clip which may describe a little bit of this. It's called Genes versus DNA versus Chromosomes. Hopefully I haven't played this one already.
You can think of DNA, genes, and chromosomes as forming a kind of blueprint of life. These are the plans that tell the body how to make things, in this case proteins, which are the body's basic building blocks. But unlike a blueprint for a house where all the information is stored on a flat piece of paper, the blueprint of life has many levels of organization to it. Let's start with DNA, the most basic level. A DNA molecule is made up of a sugar backbone and four flavors of a molecule called a nucleotide. These nucleotides are arranged along the backbone in a unique order. When your body needs a particular protein, it reads the sequence of nucleotides and uses it as a template to make that protein. Moving up a level of organization, we have genes. Genes are long snippets or chunks of DNA. They're also the most basic unit of inheritance. Traits are passed on from parents to children in the form of genes. Genes include other information about building proteins. For example, they tell the body how long a protein should be and how much to make and when to make it. Genes also have directions about where DNA can be edited out to make proteins with different functions. This is how the body makes an estimated 1 million proteins from only 20,000 genes. The next level up is the chromosome. Humans have 46 of these, arranged in pairs. Chromosomes are long strands of DNA wrapped around beach ball-like proteins called histones. Chromosomes contain many genes, along with long stretches of DNA, whose purpose we've yet to figure out. In order to make a protein, DNA has to be unwound from its histones. This is controlled by a process called acetylation, and it's just another level of control the body has over the production of proteins. So as you can see, the blueprint for our bodies is quite well organized. Only that was the case for the rest of our lives. For Scientific American's Instant Egghead, I'm Eric Olson.
Okay, I have a rather large clip. It's called DNA Episode 1 of 5, Secret of Life. It's actually a PBS documentary. And I'll go ahead and start this clip. I may not play it all. It's quite long. But I think it's quite interesting. So let's listen.
What is the force at the heart of life? What is the engine that drives it forward? That links all living things from the smallest to the largest, that links families through generations, in looks, in personality, in health, and in sickness. Scientists had searched for the answer for hundreds of years, until 1953, when two young men ran into a British pub shouting that they'd discovered the secret of life.
The most beautiful girl in the world, and you're going to see her again. You know, it was great.
The secret was DNA, a microscopic strand of only four chemicals, but capable of such infinite variety that it carries the blueprint and directs the growth of every living thing on Earth. The genetic revolution was about to begin. For the next 50 years, whole new fields of science and technology burst into being as our understanding of the genetic code buried in DNA grew.
It's going to transform everything.
Just the bare surface has been scratched.
Science will never be the same.
There were hopes for healthier lives.
That stuff kept me alive and is keeping me alive right now.
promises of an end to inherited disease.
I think I've mapped a gene for inherited breast cancer.
Cancer is a solvable problem.
I don't have to say anything. I'm going to cure cancer.
The excitement of discovery.
Dizzy. Sometimes when I start to talk about it, I get giddy.
Science is like falling in love.
I just want to work all the time. I don't want to go home.
And the fear of scientists playing God.
Contamination.
The most dangerous
infection.
And outrageous experiment.
We're worried
something
about something that could fall out of the laboratory, such as a Frankenstein.
If we don't play God, who will?
Even the course of human evolution may soon be ours to control.
This is potentially the most important organized scientific effort that the human species has ever mounted.
Aspects of society will never be the same again.
This is the personal story of the scientists whose struggles and breakthroughs are transforming our biological future. The first generation to live and work in the age of DNA.
This is a hard time.
I want to go home.
Joe, please. We're contaminated. The most intense hostility.
A tempestuous discussion.
Selfish bastards.
It was like running a marathon race that lasts for 4 years.
It's absolutely fascinating.
The DNA story begins more than half a century ago with a group of brilliant, competitive, and temperamental young scientists, all driven to uncover the same elusive mystery. And with Francis Crick and James Watson, two complete unknowns who somehow found what they were all looking for, the secret of life. To appreciate what Watson and Crick did, we have to imagine we're in the 1950s, and all that is known about life is what can be seen through a microscope. Cells dividing. They divide and divide again until somehow they eventually form a plant, a penguin, or a person. But how? How do the cells know what to do? Most believed there was a magical life force that would forever elude science, but some had faith in a more rational answer. To tell the story of how the extraordinary breakthrough was made, one has to come to Cambridge University in England. It's a place where many great discoveries have been made during the past 700 years, but if the place has the hallmarks of greatness, Watson and Crick did not. Today, Francis Crick has a house on the edge of the Mojave Desert in California, and he's become a little reclusive when it comes to discussing the early days of DNA. Some say it's because he's ill. Others say he finds the whole subject uncomfortable, or maybe he's just busy with his more recent work, studying the chemical nature of dreams. Whatever the reason, he rarely gives interviews. But Jim Watson does. Today he's 74 years old, world famous, and a multimillionaire. But he was just a 22-year-old junior researcher when he set out to explain life in scientific terms. Still, all these years later, one gets a sense of the brash young man who is planning to overthrow the old ways of thinking.
You know, if you looked at Cambridge, you know, we were products of God. The statement that life could be understood finally in terms of molecules, people say it was a hypothesis. Francis and I, what united us is, I wish I thought religion was wrong. Not necessarily silly, but wrong. There was no God, and humans had to make our own rules, not just obey rules because someone said they came from God. You realize that, you know, the people, you know, thought we were slightly crazy. But we didn't think we were. So we thought the other people were dull.
Dull or not, the other people at Cambridge didn't hold out much hope of Watson and Crick doing anything at all, let alone finding the secret of life. Watson, this geeky American kid, with his friend Crick, who acted like some dandy English gentleman, a splendid talker who had never quite managed to finish his PhD. They were seen as lazy jokers. But they shared the same dream. Like other scientists of the time, they believed that there was some kind of a script or instruction that told cells what to do. The search for this script focused on the chromosomes, right in the middle of every cell. But that was as far as they could see. Still, it was known that chromosomes were made of two discrete ingredients, proteins and DNA. Most scientists expected to find the script in the proteins because they're really complicated and made up of lots of different chemicals, so they distracted the best minds. But Watson and Crick decided to look at the simpler DNA. DNA is composed of only four ingredients. They thought if they could work out how the atoms of these four ingredients were arranged in physical space, they might be able to work out what they did. They had a hunch that the three-dimensional structure of DNA might reveal its function. But while Watson and Crick had never found the structure of anything, 60 miles away in London worked another pair of scientists who had. Rosalind Franklin and Morris Wilkins. Rosalind Franklin is often seen as the heroine of this story. She was Jewish from a wealthy background and had attended the best schools in England. She had chosen to become an expert in taking photographs of things that are too small to see. She's been called the Dark Lady of DNA, as she died without ever getting credit for her part in the discovery. Some say she was betrayed by her colleague at King's College, London. If you go to King's, along a remote corridor, and down these stairs, 50 years later, you'll still find that colleague, Morris Wilkins. And on the walls of his office are clues which hint at what he's been through. During the Second World War, he helped to create the atom bomb. The night it was dropped on Hiroshima, he was at a party celebrating the culmination of that work when a man came up to him and said something that would change his life.
It was being Monday when the bomb went off, and he said, I call it Black Monday. I always hoped it wouldn't work. I sort of stood there and felt a bit small. And then said, yes, I think you're quite right. But it did work. And so we are living kind of in the aftermath of that.
Disillusioned with the science of death, he chose the science of life instead. And that's why he decided to look for the structure of DNA.
Well, here is one of the X-ray generators we're using in this work. Here is the X-ray tube.
Wilkins's strange contraption is in fact a kind of camera. It's used in a technique called X-ray crystallography. A crystalline form of DNA is placed inside the camera, and when X-rays are fired through it, they scatter onto photographic paper and form a regular pattern. It's a bit like shining a spotlight at a chandelier. Light hits the crystals and then diffracts onto the wall. Now imagine you can't see the chandelier. You can only see the light on the wall. From that, you have to guess the shape of the chandelier. And that's what these photographs are. Taken by Morris Wilkins, they were the first clue to the structure of DNA. But his boss realized he was onto something big and decided to bring in an expert, Rosalind Franklin.
Suddenly, it wasn't just Wilkins taking photographs of DNA. So Watson and Crick were looking for the structure of DNA in Cambridge, and Wilkins and Franklin were doing the same in London. But there was someone else lurking out there, someone with a formidable reputation. The brilliant American chemist Linus Pauling. He died years ago. But his son witnessed the dramatic events, and we found him in the middle of Wales, miles from the nearest town. In this house is Peter Pauling.
It's very often in science that the times are right, and different people have the same idea, you know, at roughly the same time. And getting in first somehow is important.
They were in a race. Peter Pauling knew them all and watched this piece of history unfold. His father, who was about to become a double Nobel Prize winner, certainly had the best credentials.
Pa did very few things by accident. He did things, he had a reason for doing things. To Pa, DNA was just a substance like sodium chloride.
Linus Pauling looked for the structures of many molecules, and he usually found them too. That's why in the world of 1950s science, he was one of the most recognizable figures.
I like to understand the world. I like to learn about new ideas. But I also like very much having new ideas myself or making discoveries myself. This pleases me immensely.
He had a different approach. He was going to guess the structure by building ball and spoke models that looked like a child's Tinker Toy set. The balls represent the atoms. The spokes determine how far apart the atoms must be from each other according to the laws of physics. Linus Pauling would work at seeing how they fit together. Solving a structure this way was like doing a three-dimensional jigsaw puzzle. So Watson and Crick had a choice: to do the painstaking X-ray work or try their luck building models like Linus Pauling. For them, the choice was simple.
To build models. It was only a question when you started to build the models. Would you do it after you collected years of experimental data, or would you try and build the model with a minimum of data?
They went for model building with the minimum of data. Some might say a more leisurely approach, but that was the Cambridge style. And Watson and Crick seemed to be the epitome of that, whiling away the hours, chatting about the secret of life.
People would laugh at us and say, oh, we weren't doing experiments. Just take these long walks at lunch and constantly talking instead of experimenting.
Happy day.
People see you do no experiments.
Well, folks, unfortunately, we're out of time this evening. I want you to all press that follow button. If you haven't done so already, you'll be notified when the next Ohio Exopolitics is. Also, Google Ohio Exopolitics, and you'll find the website. You'll find the website exopoliticsohio.us, where I post a lot of the MP3s for the shows, and that way you can listen to some of the shows from Revolution Radio. Thanks so much for listening this evening. My name is Mark Snyder, and we'll be back before too long. Have a good evening.